Guru Binakona Sahai. Without the Guru, who will save you from hell? Mother, father, son, friend, wife, oh brother, all have self-interests. In this world, the friend of spirituality is the Satguru, who frees you from attachments. The ocean of the world is very deep, full of suffering, more than the mother's womb. Sitting in the boat of knowledge, you are taken across by the ferryman, the Guru. Erasing birth after birth, the Guru chases away all doubts, and the perfect Parabrahma Parameshwar is revealed within. Accept the Guru's word in your heart and keep devotion and love in your mind. O Brahmanand, do constant seva, and you will get the boon of liberation. Without the Guru, who will save you from hell? Bhajan of Brahmanand on page 176.
Guru Bina Kona Sahai Narak Mehe, Guru Bina Kona Sahai Re, Guru Bina Kona Sahai Narak Mehe, Guru Bina Kona Sahai Re. Mata Pita Suta Bandhava Nahari Swarata Ke Sababai Re. Mata Pita Suta Bandhava Nahari Swarata Ke Sababai Re. Parama Rataka Bandhu Chitata Mehe Sata Guru Bandha Chudai Re. Guru Bina Kona Sahai Narata Mehe Guru Bina Kona Sahai Re. Guru Bina Kona Sahai Narata Mehe Guru Bina Kona Sahai Re. Bhava Sagara Jala Dushtara Pari Garabase Dukadai Re. Bhava Sagara Jala Dushtara Pari Garabase Dukadai Re. Guru Kevatiya Paralangaha Ke Jnana Jaha Japatai Re. Guru Bina Kona Sahai Naraka Mehe Guru Bina Kona Sahai Re. Guru Bina Kona Sahai Naraka Mehe Guru Bina Kona Sahai Re. Janama janamaka metta andera sansa sakala nasaire. Janama janamaka metta andera sansa sakala nasaire. Parabrahma Parameshara Purana Gatame Deitikai Re. Guru Bina Kona Sahai Narakame Guru Bina Kona Sahai Re. Guru
Without the Guru, who will save you from hell? I want to begin today with a reading that is based on something that Don read last week, sheds more light on it, clarifies it. This is from a talk of Kripal's, actually based on a hymn of Brahmananda, or at least he quotes from Brahmananda in the course of it. It was published in the August 1970 satsang dash called The Unique Philosopher's Stone, and these are the last couplet and the last few paragraphs of that talk. Those who accompany the master vibrate with the goodness of him, meeting such a master in whom God is vibrating. The company of a person who has become truth itself has a purity, an uplifting impulse, for he is permeated with God, and so you will also become permeated. His is the very best kind of company to have. Kabir Sahib says, in one day have his darshan many times. If you cannot, then twice a day, and if not that, then twice a week, or once a week, if not in 15 days or once a month. If you are without his darshan for a year, your connection with him will become weak. Such strong stress of importance did Kabir Sahib lay upon the company of the master. It once happened that a man who had been in Africa for 6 or 7 years came to Baba Sawan Singh Ji. I was present that day, and he said to the master, Maharaj, Kabir Sahib has said that if a disciple does not have his master's darshan for a year, his connection breaks. Baba Sawan Singh Ji replied, it was Kabir Sahib who said that, not I. Oh, brothers, if a single glance from a God-realized person falls on anyone, that connection can never be broken. Your face should be turned toward him, that's all. Near or far, it makes no difference. You will get the benefit in the same way. Just become receptive to it. Kabir says, if the master is overseas and the disciple this side of the seas, direct the surat, the attention, to him. You will derive the benefit by receptivity. When you can hear what is being spoken and see who is speaking through a television set, why can you not have benefit through receptivity? My Azur used to give the example of the calf which comes from the fields to drink his mother's milk, and the ticks which are clinging to the udder of the cow night and day do not get this nectar, but only suck the blood. There is a valuable jewel within, but only with the master's mercy can it be reached. You only need the master's single purposeful glance to have a glimpse of that jewel. He will never tell you to do this or that, and then you will get something. From the first sitting, the master will start your experience and then tell you to go ahead from there. This is the token or mark by which you can recognize his competency. He who vanquishes the dark veil to reveal the light within, a true experience of the beyond, is called a sadhu, sant, mahatma, or master. His company is called satsang. God is the highest of the highest, beyond all time and space. Can we, who are engrossed in the outgoing faculties, mind and intellect, approach him? It is through the grace of God manifested in man alone who can lift your soul into him and make you perfect. And I would like to add to that, in a talk that Fletcher Loki gave when he got back from India in 1974, in June of that year, published in Satsang Desha that month. He said a number of things that the master said and did, but in one case he described how after the Unity of Man conference, many people wanted to stay on and have the master's darshan, which they enjoyed very much. And it was becoming very difficult to maintain everything with them. Master had many things to do, etc., etc., traveling and like that. It involved also a lot of sevadars. So it became plain that Master would like people to leave at that point. Some people got it, and they left voluntarily. Master spoke with them before he left, and Fletcher says that first of all, Master had Taiji sing to him the well-known bhajan, "Let's All Go to Sirsa," which of course concludes with the line, "Your shoes are better than me because they are always at your feet." Then Master continued from that and said, "You are going away because the Master loves you very much. He wants you to have that yearning. That pain is a gift from the Master." And I will add to that also the famous statement of Baba Jamal Singh, which I have read before. "Even after 100 years of bhajan, one does not get so purified as by an intense longing for darshan, provided that the longing is real and true and the love for the Satguru is from the innermost heart." This is a very major point, which is easy to lose sight of. But one thing, comments that Kabir made and that Kripal commented and Sanchi commented on in the talk we heard last week, you know, we can't separate them from the context. When Kabir was speaking, he didn't travel much. He stayed in the Benares area all his life. And he probably had very few disciples who could not have his darshan as often as he mentions in that. And the point is, of course, if we can have it and we don't want it, then we are the losers. If we want it, we will take advantage of it, unless he indicates otherwise. But as Sawan Singh commented, times change. Kabir said that, but I have not. The focal point here is it's the longing for darshan that counts, the wanting of it, the yearning for it. If we have it at our beck and call, you know, that's the point of the image of the ticks on the udder of the cow and the calf coming in from the distant field. If we take it for granted, which, you know, I have sometimes done in the past, and many of us may have also. During Sanchi's lifetime, we were going to India once a year, sometimes, in my case, more often than that. You know, you think, well, is it going to be like this all the time? Which is why he says at the end, the farewell darshan in February 97, you will not get this opportunity again. You know, this is, you have been given this, and now you have to make the best use of it. And that glance never goes away. It is not affected by the Master's physical departure from this plane. I've often mentioned that Kripal used to give as an example of how the disciple can be influenced by the Master. The occasion of Swami Vivekananda speaking at the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1893. Tremendously important occasion, although nobody knew it, including probably Vivekananda at the time, in which basically turned around a whole point of view in the Western world, which eventually resulted in the Master's coming to the West. Master Kripal often quotes Vivekananda that he was very intimidated. I mean, there he was, this unknown person from India. On the stage was all kinds of famous leaders, intellectuals, etc., addressing a crowd of Westerners whom he knew nothing about. He said he asked for a glass of water to give him some more time. And then Master says he concentrated, he fixed his attention on Ramakrishna, his master, and instantly a flood of inspiration came to him, and he gave a talk lasting several hours, which indeed totally transformed the thought patterns of all the people that were listening to him, or many of them in any event. He became the idol of the parliament and the far and away the most renowned single speaker delegate there, and then continued throughout America and Europe, went back to India as a conquering hero, and established for once and for all the legitimacy of Indian thought as a part of American spiritual understanding. And yet, it was not that Ramakrishna was in India and Vivekananda was here. Ramakrishna had left the body 8 years before, 7 years before. So the connection was just as strong. And that is what we should never, never forget. You know, it's one thing to sit at the feet of anybody who can give us, you know, an impetus to rise up. That's a good thing. But if we don't feel drawn to anybody and we're not interested, the fact of the matter is that if we have had that connection with our master, that can never, never, never leave us. And we have it. And we don't have to have darshan once a year or twice a day or whatever. We have it all the time because the master is beyond time and space. This is of the utmost importance. You know, what we need, we have got. It's up to us to make the best use of it. Whatever we got from the master, we still have. It's so important. You know, this is the meaning of Easter. Today is Palm Sunday, next week is Easter, and Easter is the celebration of the fact that the master power is not intimidated, stopped, suffocated, strangulated by death. The master power is stronger than death and continues one way or another, and it most certainly continues through the manifestation of that master in each of his disciples. And that is what Easter represents, is the recognition of his disciples that he was still there. You know, whether we think of it as bodily or not, the Bible differs on that. St. Paul's letter to the first letter to the Corinthians makes it very clear that he's not talking about a physical body. But he is talking about a very real connection with the Master, all the same. And that is what counts. When I mentioned about context, and we have to be aware of the context in which the Master is speaking, two things come to mind. One is that when I first assembled the manuscript that became The Way of the Saints, okay, I had talked to Master about it, he had told me to do it, and after I got back from India, he wrote me a letter confirming that he had told me to do it. So I did put together a large collection of his short writings, which was substantially what is now in the book, The Way of the Saints. But when I got to India with it, Master looked at it and he made two objections. First is there were several circulars that had been issued during the 1950s that had been translated in America from his talks in India, from Hindi. And he told me he did not want those included because he had never gone over the translations and could not verify them. The main thing was that I had included a whole sequence of letters that had been published by the New York Satsang. And Master said that he did not want those letters included in the book because, he said, they were written to individual people and they don't necessarily apply to everybody. So we have to bear that in mind. When the Master is speaking, he is not only speaking to the whole world, which he often is, but he is also speaking to individuals who have specific needs. As if something he says does not seem relevant to us, maybe it isn't. It may not have been meant for us. This came to mind because of the fact that it is now very difficult for many of us to have the darshan of the Master even once a year. And maybe if we remember that what counts is the longing for the darshan and the fact that the darshan that we have never goes away, the combination of those two factors, we will understand that that it's okay. Once I was talking with Master Kripal, I believe it was at Rajpur, at his house in Rajpur, in 1969, and we were standing in front of the house talking, and Jonas Gerard was taking pictures, and he was going around us, and he was getting the Master from this angle and from that angle. He probably took 5 or 6 pictures in the space of a couple of minutes. And Master was talking without blinking an eye or breaking his... He was just talking to me, and he said in the course of that talking to me, looking me straight in the eye, he said, "You know, if you take pictures too much, they become common. They lose their value." Of course, I hadn't taken any pictures at all. I mean, he said it directly as though he was rebuking me for taking the pictures. Of course, Jonas heard him, and Jonas and I talked afterwards, and Jonas understood very well that the Master was talking to him. But it often happens that there is something specific going on when the Master says something, and there may be one reason or another why he does not wish to say it directly to the person. But still, it's the context that determines the point of it. Anyway, Master's makes that point in morning talks, actually. All right, in the spirit of Easter and Palm Sunday, I want to begin chapter 23 in The Stranger of Galilee. Search and you will find. Okay? These are perhaps the most important verses in the whole Bible. Ask and it will be given you. Search and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened for you. For everyone who asks receives, and everyone who searches finds, and for everyone who knocks, the door will be opened. Is there anyone among you who, if your child asks for bread, will give a stone? Or if the child asks for a fish, will give a snake? If you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good things to those who ask him? In everything, do to others as you would have them do to you. For this is the law and the prophets. And it's Matthew 7, 7 through 12. There is an enormous amount to consider in connection with this passage. There are 3 parts to what is both a commandment and a promise. We are commanded to do 3 things: ask, search, and knock. And we are promised that if we do these things, we will be successful. These 3 parts of the commandment promise are related to the 3 aspects of the search that all of us have to undergo: the physical or geographical, the finding of the Master outwardly, the psychological or mental, what Master Kripal Singh always called man-making or becoming a human being, and the spiritual, the finding of God. Of these three, the first two are the most important because success in the first two makes the third easy. As Master Kripal used to say, finding God is not difficult. Making a man is difficult. Perhaps it should be repeated here that his use of the term man is gender-free. In Urdu, the word that he used was insan, as in the original of the title, Man Know Thyself. O insan apne apko jaan. O human being, why don't you know your own self? Insan translates as human being and has the root meaning of one who is love personified, overflowing with love and radiating love for all, which is a quote from How I Met My Master, Kripal's talk in January 1964. That is what we are supposed to be, one who is love personified. And that is what we can be if we search within ourselves for that which makes it possible. So the first two commandments, asking and searching, are the most important. And in this sermon, since Jesus is addressing his disciples who have already found him, he doesn't put much emphasis on the first one except in this particular passage. Overall, most of the sermon is about the second commandment, the psychological or mental search, because that is the hardest to achieve. In a few places here and there, we have seen that he is concerned with the spiritual third aspect of the commandment. But basically, his attention is on the second part. The golden rule stated here is seen as a touchstone, a way to tell if we are adequately moving forward in the psychological quest. In everything, do to others as you would have them do to you. But this is the law and the prophets. We can tell we're progressing if we meet the criterion of treating others the way we want them to treat us. And of course, the law and the prophets, that refers, it's a short way of referring to what we call the Old Testament. The word law, the Greek term nomos, translates the Hebrew Torah, which is the first five books. And the prophets is the Nevi'im, or the second major section of the Old Testament, and the Jewish version, which is what Jesus knew, of course, including what are called the early prophets, the books of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, and the later prophets, which is what Christians usually refer to as the prophetical books. Then the Psalms and the other writings came afterwards. But it's very common to refer to the Old Testament in this way. There are some other things to consider along with this. One is in the Gospel of John. Then Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, "If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." John 8:31. The phrase, "if you continue in my word," has a double meaning. It means if you follow the direction I have verbally laid down for you, and it also refers to the esoteric meaning of word as the power which has created the universe and is present in each of us as light and sound. So, if you continue in my word, both meanings, you are truly my disciples, not otherwise, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. This is the substance of both the commandment and the promise given in the sermon. The great thing about knowing the truth is that it liberates us. There is another section in the Gospel of John that Master Kripal quoted very often. "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house there are many dwelling places. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, so that where I am, there you may be also. And you know the way to the place where I am going." Thomas said to him, "Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way?" Jesus said to him, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you know me, you will know my Father also. From now on, you do know him and have seen him." Philip said to him, "Lord, show us the Father and we will be satisfied." Jesus said to him, "Have I been with you all this time, Philip, and you still do not know me? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me?" And that's from John 14, 1 through 10. Subsequent Christian theology, of course, has particularized this teaching and turned it into dogma. But we need not concern ourselves with that viewpoint. What we should know is that Jesus is really talking about the absolute necessity of our knowing the living Master. "Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me?" Through the presence and help of a human being who is alive in the world at the same time that we are, who has reached God, who has accomplished the three stages of the quest, physical, mental, and spiritual, we can have the strength to do what we have to do. In the Sarbachan, Jesus' statements about searching and finding are given unqualified support in this famous section. Of course, this is from Swamiji Maharaj. "God is within everyone, but nobody knows him. People commit sins while he looks on, but he does not prevent them and makes them go through the wheel of transmigration. What good then is this God to us? But when we meet a Satguru and he explains to us in what form God is present in our hearts, then we are informed and avoid bad deeds and escape the wheel of transmigration. Hence it is necessary to seek a Satguru, for he is the God manifest. And the search for the unmanifested God is not possible without the help of the Satguru. Those who don't do so will neither find God nor escape the wheel of transmigration, but waste this precious human life. And whoever seeks the Satguru will surely find him, for the Satguru is an incarnation eternally present on this earth." Sarbachan 2, 208. In other words, the Master is always here. And as Master Kirpal Singh used to point out about the law of supply and demand, it is the need of the seeker which creates the presence of the Master. This process has been brought out in a number of stories. Sanchi has told us about Paltu and his friends who made a pact to search. There was not a Master on the earth at that time, but because they were searching in great sincerity, God himself came down to earth, took the form of a human being, and initiated them. So in a very real sense, the seeker's need creates the presence of the Master. And that is why Jesus could say, "Search and you will find, and know the promise would be fulfilled." The following story has to do with searching in the physical world for the Master. But it's important to realize that we may not consciously know we are looking for him. Some people do, but everyone's story is different. In my case, I consciously searched very hard and eventually found the Master. And in that search, I was inspired and comforted by the promise Jesus gave in the passage just quoted from John 14. I knew he was with me and that he would help me to find what I was looking for. But that's not the only way to do it. People come from all kinds of different backgrounds and situations, and a seeker may not even be aware that he is seeking. This story is told of Baba Sawan Singh. This is a quote which I have read a number of times. It's worth reading again from a book called The Call of the Great Master, which is a verbatim record of a series of conversations Sawan Singh with various people, including not just disciples, but Christian missionaries and others. At this moment, a number of Gorkha Nepalese satsangis, who were military officers in the Baklo cantonment, about 10 miles from Dalhousie, came to see the great master. They fell at his feet. A lady member of the party wet his feet with her tears and would not leave them. A member of the European missionary party, which was also present, remarked that this was an ignominious debasing of human dignity. The great master said, "I have tried my best to stop these people from behaving like this, but nobody listens to me. I do not like this habit of touching the feet." At this, the American lady, Miss E., quietly took the Bible from her missionary friend's hand and read the following passage from it. "And behold, a woman in the city, which was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at meat in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster box of ointment and stood at his feet behind him, weeping, and began to wash his feet with tears and did wipe them with the hairs of her head and kissed his feet and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee which had bidden him saw this, he said to himself, 'This man, if he were a prophet, would have known what manner of woman this is that touches his feet, for she is a sinner.'" That is to say, a harlot or prostitute. "Then Jesus answering said unto Simon, 'There was a certain creditor who had two debtors. One owed him 500 pence and the other 50. They had nothing to pay. The creditor frankly forgave them both. Tell me now, which of them will love him more?' Simon answered, 'That whom he forgave most.' Then he turned to the woman and said unto Simon, 'Seest thou this woman? I entered thy house. Thou gavest me no water for my feet, but she hath washed my feet with tears and wiped them with the hairs of her head. Thou gavest me no kiss, but this woman since the time I came in hath not ceased to kiss my feet. My head with oil thou didst not anoint, but this woman hath anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore I say unto thee, her sins which are many are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loved little. And he said unto her, Thy sins are forgiven, thy faith hath saved thee, go in peace.'" And that's from the Gospel of Luke 7:37 through 50. "This scene described by Luke is of daily occurrence at the Dera," said Mr. Veerban. Professor Jagmohan Lal commented, "Christ is always doing things like that. That is the habit of all the Christs. The great master would stop me, but otherwise I would have related a very interesting story to you." "We will ask the great master not to stop you," said the American lady. "Please tell us the story." At this stage, the great master went inside the house to have a drink of water, leaving the professor to relate the following story. Once the great master went to Amritsar for satsang. It was his custom to give a satsang there on every Sankrant, the first day of every Hindu month. He was going to the satsangar on the Majita road in his car, and the road was very crowded. People were going to the satsangar in cars, tangas, bicycles, and rickshaws, and a very large number were on foot. He was at a distance of about 2 furlongs from the satsangar, but at a turn in the road, a man suddenly fell down in front of his car. The driver stopped the car and the great master got down to see what had happened. A drunkard had fallen right in front of the car, but luckily he had escaped quite unhurt. The great master, with the help of a companion of the drunken man, tried to make him stand on his feet, but he was too drunk to walk steadily. A number of satsangis who had gathered around him helped him to get out of the way. When the great master left, the drunkard asked who was the siddhar in the car. For the great master's majestic figure could not but impress this peasant, even though he was not in his full senses. His companion, who was also half tipsy, told him, perhaps just by way of leg pulling, that the people around said that he was God, who had come to earth to save sinners like him. God he seems to be, and I want to go to him to have my sins forgiven, the peasant said. And after a few minutes, he, with a half-emptied bottle of liquor in his pocket, reached the satsangar reclining on the shoulder of his companion. The great master was sitting in an easy chair, relaxing himself. We noticed this man only when suddenly, with unsteady steps, he tumbled down at the feet of the great master, placed his head on his feet, and locked the great master's legs in his arms. "You are God. Forgive me my sins," he begged. "No, I am not God," said the great master, trying to release himself from his grip. "I am a sinner like you. Now get up, my son." "I will not rise unless you say that you have forgiven me," said the peasant. The great master laughed involuntarily, and with the laughter came his forgiveness. Manohar, the master's personal attendant, and Jamadar Partap Singh wanted to remove the man by force, but the great master stopped them from doing so. "Well," he said with a smile, "this is a strange way of getting forgiveness by force." The drunkard began to weep bitterly. "Say what you like, but I won't leave your feet until you forgive me," he said. The great master laughed heartily and put both his hands on the man's head. "Well, rise up, for you are forgiven, my son," he said. "All my sins? Am I saved from the hell fire?" asked the peasant, raising his head. "Yes, your faith has saved you," replied the great master. In the evening, the peasant was found standing in the queue, waiting for initiation. A few were rejected, but he was among those who were accepted. "You will have to abstain from alcoholic drinks and animal foods in the future," the great master warned him. "Wine I can never give up. It is simply impossible for me," the man replied. "Well then, promise one thing, and that is that you would never take it in my presence," said the great master. "That I do promise, sir," said the peasant. "How do you earn your livelihood?" the great master asked. "By theft and robbery," was the surprising reply. "That must be given up. You must choose some other profession," said the great master. "I don't know any other profession," the man told him. "But you must start to earn your living in some other way now that you have been initiated," the great master insisted. "I cannot do anything else and have never done anything else," said the peasant. "All right, then promise me one thing more, that you will not steal any more than you actually need, and that you will not take anyone else with you when you go out to steal." "That I promise with all my heart," the man replied. Before leaving, he again fell at the master's feet. The master again blessed him by putting both of his hands on his head. After this, he committed theft only once. Following his initiation, he went to attend the marriage ceremony of a female relative who lived in Gurdaspur district, and while there he ran short of money. One night he entered the house of a Baniya banker and broke open his strong box. Just as he had taken hold of a bundle of currency notes, the heavy upper lid of the iron chest fell upon his arm, wounding it grievously and holding it fast as in a trap. All his cunning and cleverness failed to release him. When, after a long struggle, he finally gave himself up as lost, the great master appeared before him. Helping the robber to free his arm, he said, "Had you not promised me not to steal any more than you needed?" Now run away to save your life and leave everything here. After that, the peasant never again committed any theft. And that is from the book, The Call of the Great Master, pages 172 to 178. Gangu, the robber in the story, is a famous person in the Sant Mat tradition in India, and Sanchi has referred to him many times, explaining his background and how he had become a robber for reasons not of his own making. The point is that Gangu did not even know he was searching, but he was, because as soon as he met the master, he recognized him and knew what to ask. Many people who seemed to live far better lives and who were more in control of themselves did not know what the master really was. Like Gangu, we may not know we are searching until suddenly we are awakened. When Sanchi was here at Sant Bani Ashram in May 1977, he asked me to do the screening for initiation. A young woman from Martha's Vineyard came and I asked, "Well, how long have you been on the diet?" She said, 2.5 weeks. I said, "That's not long enough. You have to be on the diet for 3 months before you can be initiated." To which she replied, "Well, whether I can be initiated or not, I don't know, but this is why I'm here. I was walking on the vineyard when a friend stopped the car and said, 'I'm on my way to Boston to see a saint. Do you want to come with me?' I had never thought about this kind of thing, but the idea appealed to me, so I got in the car, got on the ferry, and rode up to the airport. This was the moment when Sanchi was flying in. As soon as I saw him, I realized that this was everything I had ever wanted in my whole life. And from that moment, I have not eaten anything that I shouldn't have eaten or done anything I shouldn't have done. But before that, I didn't know. I talked to Sanchi about her, and he approved her application, and she was initiated at that time. So we don't always know we're searching until suddenly we find the master. There are many different ways of coming to his feet." And I will continue reading that next time. There's another story I want to share with you. And this is not something I have told publicly very often. In fact, maybe never, although I have mentioned it sometimes privately to people. It goes along with both the idea of the prostitute and the story of Jesus and the bandit and robber and alcoholic and the story of Baba Sawan Singh, that once a man came to me, this was back in the 80s, and wanted initiation from Sanchi, and he said that he could not be a vegetarian. There was some problem with his stomach, and I do not remember the technicalities of what it was, but he had tried and tried, and he could not manage to handle a vegetarian diet. He reacted against every kind of non-animal food. I talked with him and he said he had been to doctors and he wanted to be a vegetarian but he couldn't be. And every time he tried it, he got very, very sick. Something about the way his stomach and intestines were connected to the rest of him, I don't really know. Anyway, I said, "Well, I can't give you the initiation because you have to be a vegetarian for at least 3 months." And he said, "Well, will you ask the master about my case?" And I said, "Yes, I'll do that." So I took a letter from him when I went to India about a month later. I talked with Sanchi about him, and Sanchi read his letter, and he said to me, "Well, if there's nothing he can do, what can be done? Give him the initiation." And I was very surprised, but I said, "Fine. I mean, the master says so. It's his game, he makes the rules." So I came home and he was initiated and he saw the master within at the time of initiation. So we never want to assume things about what is qualified or what is not qualified. I read a few weeks ago the story of, well, not here, I didn't, but the story of when Baba Sawan Singh went to Kripal Singh's hometown in the Punjab, Syed Khasran, and did satsang, and he initiated a number of people. As he was leaving, the schoolmaster said to him, "Well, I appreciate that you have initiated some people who are very worthy, but I don't understand why you have initiated people who are not worthy." And Baba Sahan Singh said to him, "I will tell you that I was not worthy when I got the initiation from Baba Jamal Singh." So we should always bear that in mind, both for, in the question of other people and for us. You know, everyone has their own search, their own way of dealing with things, their own karma that is being played out, their own story. And the Master knows, you know, he knows where we're at. He knows why we can do what we can do and why we can't do what we can't do. He sees very clearly everything that we are, and he loves us anyway. You know, none of us, not one of us, deserved initiation when we got it. Not one. And we got it anyway, because he loved us. As Master said so many times, Master Kripal, it is he who first loves us. Our love is only reciprocal. We respond to his love. All the commandments, all the rules that we call them, you know, the whole way of life that is laid out for us, they're not rules to keep or we'll go to hell, as the Bhajan says. They're expressions of his love for us in that they show us how to avoid what will cause us more pain. And we have to remember them in that light. Certain things, if we stick our hand on a hot stove, we'll get burned. When our mother tells us not to stick our hand on a hot stove, she's not making up a rule. You know, she doesn't want us to get burned. And it's like that. That's the point of the commandments. And we follow them because the one who gave them to us loves us, and we respond to that love. As Jesus said, "If you love me, keep my commandments." That, I've often said, that was framed, that particular quote was framed on the wall of the porch at Sawan Ashram. Everyone who went in and had the Master's darshan there, which was many of us, every time we looked at the Master, it was right behind him where he was sitting. We read that, couldn't help it, it was right there. So these are things that are important. Our closing bhajan is on page 274. Ek darmandi ki halat tumhe batan. I tell you the condition of the heart that is in pain. I tell you what exactly love is. The revelation of the secret of love is the insult of love. One may perish but not bring the name of his beloved on his lips. What does one have to do with the world? What does one have to ask from the world? I ask you, what exactly is the loyalty in love? The one sick in love died in separation, saying, "Who wants to wait more? Who knows whether he will come or not? He who used to keep me awake is himself awake now. The sighs of the poor heart do not cease, and they have never gone unanswered. I tell you the condition of the heart that is in pain. I tell you what exactly love is." Bhajan of Master Kripal Singh on page 274.
Ek dard mand dil ki halat tumhe batai, kya cheez hai mohabbat, aao tumhe sunai. Ek dard mand dil ki halat tumhe batai, kya cheez hai mohabbat, aao tumhe sunaye. Afshaye raz ulfat tauhine ashki hai, afashayraze ulafat tauhine yashkihe mit jaye lab peleki mit jaye lab peleki kyun nam un kalaye ik darad mand dilaki halat tumhe batai kya chi hai mahaba au tumhe sunai duniya se kya garaz hai duniya se poochne kya duniya se kya garaz hai duniya se poochna kya main tujhse poochta hu main tujhse poochta hu kya cheez hai wafa hai ek dard mand dil ki halat tumhe batai kya cheez hai mahaba aao tumhe sunaye bimar ne ye khakara furkat mein jaan de di bimar ne ye khakara furkat mein jaan de di ab kon rahe dekhe ab kon rahe dekhe wo aayin yaad aaye ik dard mand dil ki halat tumhe bataye kya cheez hai mahaba aao tumhe sunaye mujhko jagan wale ab khud bhi jagte hain mujhko jagan wale kab khud bhi jagte hain majboor dil kiya hai majboor dil kiya hai khali gayi na jaye ek dard mand dil ki halat tumhe bataye kya cheez hai mahabbat aao tumhe sunaye
I tell you the condition of the heart that is in pain. I tell you what exactly love is. May God bless us all.